Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The head of the UN's World Food Programme, WFP, Cindy McCain, said on Monday that the agency is resuming operations in Sudan following a temporary suspension after the deaths of three WFP aid workers on the 15th of April. Ms. McCain stressed that the crisis in Sudan is pushing millions into hunger and announced the distribution of desperately needed food assistance in the states of Gedaref, Gezira, Kassala, and White Nile in the coming days. The WFP executive director recognized that the security situation is still highly precarious and insisted that to best protect our necessary humanitarian workers and the people of Sudan, the fighting must stop. Over 15 million people faced severe food insecurity in Sudan before the start of the military power struggle last month. We expect these numbers to grow significantly as the fighting continues, Ms. McCain said. On Sunday, the UN announced Secretary General Antonio Guterres' decision to send Humanitarian Affairs Chief Martin Griffiths to the region immediately. Mr. Griffiths warned that the situation in Sudan is reaching breaking point and that the UN is working with partners to reboot the aid response following massive looting of relief organizations' offices and warehouses. In response to Afghanistan's deepening humanitarian crisis, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres convened a high-level international meeting in Doha on Monday. The move came after the UN chief tweeted that reversing restrictions on women's rights was key to reaching the millions of people in Afghanistan who need assistance urgently. The meeting is intended to achieve a common understanding within the international community on how to engage with the Taliban on women's and girls' rights, countering terrorism and drug trafficking, the UN said in a statement. Representatives from the United States, China, Russia, Europe and Pakistan are reportedly among those taking part in 2 days of talks in the Qatari capital. The Taliban returned to power in August 2021 and have restricted Afghan women and girls from participating in most areas of public and daily life. Women nationals have also been barred from working with the UN in a country where nearly 29 million people depend on humanitarian assistance. Last week, the UN Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution condemning the work ban for women, saying that it undermines human rights and humanitarian principles. Over 2,000 delegates from around the world gathered in Geneva on Monday to discuss how best to curb chemical pollution, which has had increasingly dire consequences for health and the environment. Over the course of 2 weeks of meetings, countries are expected to make progress on adding new so-called forever chemicals to the list of toxic substances to be banned or restricted under the Stockholm Convention. They will also seek ways to further regulate the use of chemicals and pesticides under the Rotterdam Convention and develop technical guidelines on the sound management of plastic and e-waste under the Basel Convention. According to the World Health Organization, WHO, in 2019, a small number of chemicals for which data are available were estimated to have caused 2 million deaths, including from heart and respiratory diseases as well as cancers. Meanwhile, WHO says that chemical sales are on the rise worldwide and are projected to almost double from 2017 to 2030. Later this month, the international community will come together again in Paris to continue work towards a new, legally binding international treaty on plastic pollution. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a great time. It's 56 degrees here in northeast Kansas and rising. Very, very sunny day today. Here is this morning's headlines from Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Medical workers in Sudan are warning of a mounting catastrophe as airstrikes continue to rock Khartoum despite a declared ceasefire between Sudan's army and a rival paramilitary group. 18 days into the fighting, Sudan's healthcare system has largely collapsed. Aid workers are describing increasingly desperate scenes with bodies piled in the streets of the capital and critical shortages of water, food, and fuel. The United Nations Refugee Agency warned Monday the crisis could push more than 800,000 people out of Sudan. This is Raouf Massou, the UN's Assistant High Commissioner for Refugees.
Without a quick resolution of this crisis, we will continue to see more people forced to flee in search of safety and basic assistance. Thus far, about 73,000 people have arrived in neighboring countries.
Ukraine's government says a fresh wave of Russian missile attacks has destroyed an ammunition depot and injured dozens of civilians. This follows Russian attacks over the weekend, blamed for 24 civilian deaths. On Monday, Ukraine's military struck inside Russian territory, derailing a freight train in the Russian border region of Bryansk, whose governor also said Ukrainian shelling on a Russian village killed four civilians. On Saturday, Ukrainian drone strikes blew up an oil depot in the Russian-annexed Crimean Peninsula. Meanwhile, the leader of the private Russian mercenary firm Wagner Group has threatened mutiny unless Moscow agrees to send his forces more ammunition as they battle for control of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine. Yevgeny Prigozhin lashed out against Russia's military establishment in a video posted on a Russian social media channel.
Happy birthday, and happy birthday to Wagner Group. If the company is destined to die, it won't be at the hands of the Ukrainian army or NATO, but because of our domestic bastard bureaucrats.
On Monday, the Biden administration said Russia has suffered 100,000 casualties since December, with more than 20,000 Russian fighters killed in action. Many of the dead and wounded are Russian convicts whose sentences were pardoned in exchange for joining Wagner's mercenary army. President Joe Biden welcomed Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. to the White House Monday, saying the United States remains ironclad in its defense of the Philippines, including the South China Sea. The meeting came after Marcos granted the Pentagon access to four more of military bases in the Philippines and following the largest ever U.S.-Filipino joint war games in the South China Sea. Protesters gathered outside the White House Monday to denounce the military alliance. This is Nina Makalpanak of the group Bayan USA.
Supposedly, they are going to reaffirm their special relationship between the U.S. and the Philippines. But we know that that means the relationship between the colonizer and the colonized. Marcos is not welcome here. Stop selling out the Philippines!
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned Monday the United States could default on its debts as early as June 1st unless Congress takes action to raise the limit on the national debt. Yellen's warning came less than a week after House Republicans approved a bill to raise the debt limit in exchange for a 13% cut in discretionary spending, with huge cuts to programs including student debt relief, food assistance, Medicaid, and renewable energy. On Monday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer pressed ahead with a two-year suspension of the federal debt ceiling that would not contain federal spending limits. The Senate is set to hold a hearing on the debt ceiling this Thursday, and President Biden has called House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and other congressional leaders to a White House meeting May 9th. The Senate Judiciary Committee is holding a hearing on Supreme Court ethics reform today amidst a mounting series of scandals among justices. In recent weeks, it's been revealed that Justice Neil Gorsuch sold a property he co-owned to the head of a major law firm that has since had 22 cases before the Supreme Court. And ProPublica reports Justice Clarence Thomas failed to disclose gifts and payments from Texas billionaire and conservative activist Harlan Crow. In the latest revelations, Business Insider reports the wife of U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts was paid $10.3 million in commissions as a job recruiter placing lawyers at elite law firms. Jane Sullivan Roberts earned hundreds of thousands of dollars from one law firm that argued a case before Chief Justice Roberts. Syria's government says one soldier was killed and seven people wounded earlier today as Israeli warplanes bombed the main airport in the northern city of Aleppo, knocking it out of service. This follows hundreds of Israeli attacks on Syria in recent years, including two similar Israeli airstrikes in Aleppo's airport in March. The airport is key to efforts to ship humanitarian relief to northern Syria following the devastating February 6 earthquakes that killed more than 50,000 people, including over 6,000 Syrians. Palestinian prisoner Khadr Adnan has died in an Israeli prison following an 87-day hunger strike. Adnan began refusing food in February to protest his arrest under Israel's so-called administrative detention program, the policy of holding Palestinians without charge for up to years at a time. Human rights groups say Israel is holding more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners under the policy. In Brazil, at least three Yanomami indigenous leaders were killed over the weekend after heavily armed illegal miners stormed a village. The attack comes as Brazil's government continues its operation targeting illegal miners in Yanomami territory. The efforts were launched by President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva as part of his campaign to protect the Amazon and indigenous communities. Lula has legally recognized six indigenous territories, a move crucial to protecting indigenous land from illegal miners and loggers. This is Lula speaking Friday.
I do not want any indigenous land to remain undemarcated during my term in office. It is a commitment I have made and a commitment to you since the campaign. We cannot allow what happened in the Yanomami lands in the state of Roraima to happen again. This cannot happen again to any of the indigenous people.
Hollywood writers have gone on strike for the first time in 15 years. The Writers Guild of America, which represents more than 11,000 movie and TV writers, say pay and working conditions have deteriorated in recent years due to the rising of streaming services like Netflix and Amazon Prime. After headlines, we'll go to Hollywood for the latest. Millions of people took to the streets around the world to mark May Day, calling for livable wages and stronger labor protections. In Latin America, workers in Guatemala denounced corruption, intensifying repression in the country. In Chile, police clashed with protesters in the capital, Santiago. Thousands also rallied in Argentina and Venezuela, where U.S. sanctions have exacerbated poverty. In Canada, tens of thousands of federal workers have reached a deal with the government that includes higher wages, bringing an end to Canada's largest ever public sector strike for about 100,000 workers, but more than 35,000 revenue agency workers who've been on strike since mid-April are still in negotiations. In Lebanon, migrant domestic workers led a march in Beirut, demanding better working conditions and protections. In Sri Lanka, workers protested a bailout agreement with the International Monetary Fund as the country faces its worst economic crisis in history. In the United Kingdom, nurses and other workers with the National Health Service walked off the job as they continued to demand higher wages. In more news from Europe, hundreds of thousands took to the streets across France as opposition grows against President Emmanuel Macron's move to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. Close to 300 protesters were arrested as violence erupted in several cities, including Paris, with police firing tear gas at demonstrators. This is a protester in Paris.
I'm more determined than ever. Macron has to stay on for 4 more years. We will go on for 4 more years. No problem. I'm here. There will be more of us. We will win in the end. I'm convinced.
And in Puerto Rico, protesters rallied outside the San Juan offices of the Financial Oversight and Management Board, a non-elected body imposed by the U.S. government that controls the island's budget. Workers demanded the board's expulsion from Puerto Rico as debt has led to unprecedented austerity measures, including cuts to public education, pensions, and worker benefits. This is a teacher from Vieques, where protesters pushed out the U.S. Navy 20 years ago at the May Day action in San Juan Monday.
Vieques is a reflection of what happens in the rest of the country. It is also the reflection of the greatest battles in the country. As we say today, the U.S. Navy did not withdraw. We took them out. The board will not withdraw. We need to take them out.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And as a reminder, in the second hour, at the top of the hour, we'll have John Grant live for discussions. Now, the latest counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the grandson of the elderly white man who shot a black teenager in the head for ringing his doorbell told the Kansas City Star that their relationship had unraveled as his grandfather began watching, quote, Fox News all day, every day, close quote, and sank into a, quote, 24-hour news cycle of fear, of paranoia, close quote. Well, those words had a poignant resonance for many people who feel they've lost family members and friends to a kind of cult that's not secret, but pumped into the airwaves every day. Hate-fueled and hate-fueling media have political and historical impacts and interpersonal familial ones as well. The Brainwashing of My Dad, the 2016 film and the book based on it, reflect filmmaker, activist, and author Jen Senko's effort to engage the multi-level effects of that yelling, punching down reactionary media, as well as how we can respond. We'll hear from Jen Senko today on Counterspin. But first, a quick look back at some recent press. Over 340,000 workers at UPS could launch the largest strike against a single company in U.S. history this August when their collective bargaining agreement expires. As labor journalist and host of the Upsurge podcast Teddy Ostro writes for Fair.org, the top package courier in the world, which has seen two straight years of record-breaking profits, is considering whether to refuse workers' demands to raise the poverty pay of part-time warehouse workers, reestablish equal pay for equal work among delivery drivers, and introduce extreme heat-related and other safety protections, among other issues. Public understanding of negotiations between UPS and the Teamsters Union, which represents the workers, will have a lot to do with media reporting. And history urges thoughtful attention, let's say. Last year, when 115,000 railroad workers inched towards a strike, only for President Biden and Congress to legislatively force a less than satisfactory labor contract on them, news media were quick to relay their pro-corporate sympathies. Outlets declared that the Senate averted or prevented or headed off a freight rail strike that was looming and would have been crippling. Those word choices depict the potential work stoppage as a national catastrophe, threatened by greedy workers and then courageously warded off by neutral arbiters. But that crisis-averted narrative obscures the class dynamics of strikes, and that in the case of the rail strike, Biden and Congress preemptively broke one on behalf of multi-billion dollar corporations and in violation of workers' right to withhold their labor. We should look out for a similar kind of shadow to be cast on a strike at UPS, a company that transports about 6% of the country's GDP and may be railroad company's largest customer. Business Insider has warned that, quote, a driver strike threatens to upend millions of deliveries, close quote, while Fortune teed up the strike as one that could, quote, hurt virtually every American, close quote. There are exceptions, but corporate media virtually always overshadow the stakes for the workers who, among other sacrifices, forego much of their paychecks to hit the picket line, with hysterics about disruption to the flow of capital. Framing that says workers are holding the economy hostage is vague rhetoric that serves to identify the reader with corporations. Outlets like Fortune aren't making a mistake when they tell readers a strike might happen, quote, even though delivery drivers already earn upwards of $95,000 a year, close quote. They just assume readers won't bother to find out that the majority of the UPS workforce are not drivers, and many of them earn as little as $15.50 an hour. And then while outlets take pains to note UPS is spending $270 million on safety for its workers, the same outlets, oops, accidentally omit that the corporation's revenues surpassed $100 billion last year, and CEO Tomei took home $19 million in what media call, without scare quotes, compensation. Unions are more popular than they have been in nearly six decades. UPS delivery drivers are in ever more contact with an e-commerce-reliant public. And many newsrooms are actually undergoing a unionization wave themselves. So the adversities of logistic workers at multi-billion dollar corporations like Amazon and like UPS are now more popularly known. So lots of folks might be understanding of a labor action by UPS workers and might even understand that elite media might not bring them the full story. You might see that as a problem, or you could see it as an opportunity. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Brainwashing of My Dad, the 2015 film and the 2021 book based on it, are part family memoir, part historical excavation of the rise of right-wing media in the U.S., and part resource on ways we can resist its influence. Filmmaker, activist, and author Jen Senko joins us now by phone from New Jersey. Welcome to Counterspin, Jen Senko.
Thanks for welcoming, Janice. Great to be with you.
Well, I know that reactionary and hate-fueling media have been with us for a while, but reading the statements from the grandson of Andrew Lester, the 85-year-old white man who shot black 16-year-old Ralph Jarl when the teenager simply rang his doorbell, the statements from the grandson that he and his grandfather used to be close, but that unraveled as Lester, he said, fell down the right-wing rabbit hole and began watching Fox News all day, every day, blaring in his living room. Those statements really kind of squeezed my heart because they took me back to when FAIR was doing work around Rush Limbaugh, and we would get these really plaintive phone calls from people saying, I remember one, you know, my husband used to be so kind and so open-hearted, but then he started going out to the barn with his brother and listening to Rush Limbaugh. So besides memoir and historical analysis and ideas for fighting back, the film and the book are also a kind of communal release, a sharing of what had been a private lament of a lot of family of folks who had been lost to this sinkhole. You know, for me, it gets a lot of power from that, I think.
Reading about that really affected me. It also rang bells, of course, because back in the 90s, I was watching my father sink down the rabbit hole. And what many people have a problem with is they think that this media just attracts those who already, you know, have these beliefs, have these prejudices, have this hatred, have this racism. But I know for a fact that's not necessarily true. I was growing up in the 60s, and I remember at the time, everybody was super aware that, hey, we're no longer racist. We're open-minded. You know, and then there was the hippies, and then everything was on the table, and it was pretty much everybody adopted that. I don't want to call it an ideology, but the idea of openness and, you know, loving other people, mm-hmm. no matter what they were or who they loved. And then to experience my father's personality change, it was just frightening. It was like watching the invasion of the body snatchers. And then around the same time he was changing, he would say these things, and I would have friends come out and say the same exact thing around the same time. I'll give you an example. Like one time I was visiting, and he said, by the way, Jen, there's no such thing as organic. And I'm like, okay, where did that come from? And then a girlfriend of mine came up from Texas, and we had lunch. And she said to me, by the way, Jen, there's no such thing as organic. And I'm like, wait a minute. So, yeah, that story about his grandfather, Andrew, who shot Jarl, was particularly upsetting. And I just think so many people are being especially these older people, the last few years of their lives are being ruined. They're miserable. They hate. They're paranoid. They're obsessed. They're not enjoying themselves. The grandson said the grandfather sat in his chair all day and just watched, I think it was mostly Fox, but the rabbit hole is the rabbit hole, no matter what entrance you take.
Right.
Yeah, you know, if I had any message for anybody, it would be that this media is potent, it's powerful, it's meant to change people, and it does change people.
Well, and you know, the film is, of course, about your dad, about Frank Senko, and listeners should know that story has a happy ending, you know, but while it is your story, I'm just underscoring that I feel that you made it because you understood that it was not only your story. And at one point you say in the film, I finally decided to make a film to figure it out, you know, which I think a lot of creative people
yeah.
will relate to, you know, let me make something about this so that I can kind of lay it out there and think about it. Right.
Right. And in the process of making the film, I called it at that time a phenomenon. Now I call it an epidemic. Like I said in the film, like once I posted it on Kickstarter that I was doing this movie, I didn't know where all these people came from or how they heard about it, but they contacted me. And just, I mean, over the years since the film, actually the film was released in 2016. IMDb got it wrong. So
sorry about that.
But that's okay. We were at Traverse City in 2015, and that's how the date got in there. We did a work in progress. We showed that. But, yeah, so I've heard from thousands of people over the years about how their loved one, whoever it was, actually changed. And regarding my dad's change back, I think that's a really, really important note that when I used to do interviews, I would leave it off because I thought, well, I don't want to spoil the movie for anybody. But there's going to be people that are listening that aren't going to see the movie. The important thing to know is that my dad changed back to himself, and it was through removal of that media. Do you want me
Absolutely,
to?
Absolutely. I think it's kind of a remarkable story in a way.
It is. And I laugh just because it makes me happy. So my parents, in 2010, they moved to a senior community, and somewhere in the move, my dad's radio broke, and he put it in the garage, and it just sat there, and he didn't fix it. So immediately, he was sans his three-hour lunches with Rush Limbaugh. So he kind of actually mellowed a little bit right away. And we didn't want to remind him, you know, you've got to fix your radio, whatever. So that was a really, really, really big, big thing. Probably, I'd say maybe the first biggest thing. Then the second thing that happened is, I guess it was a few months later, the TV in the kitchen that they watched during lunch was very old, and my mom got a new one, and she programmed the remotes. And they had stickies all over them, you know, do this, do that, do this. So my dad didn't bother. He just left on what she had on. And I think she watched MSNBC or just different, mm-hmm. you know, various news shows. They always watched the news. And then, might have been a year later, I'm not sure, sometime later, my dad went into the hospital for a kidney stone, and he was there for a week. And they had these really old computers, and my mom was afraid that the computers were getting clogged up, and she asked me to delete some of his email. But I said, look, they just keep coming. You have to unsubscribe them, and I don't have time to do that. So she did it, but she added something. She not only unsubscribed him from all this vile email from, I mean, dozens of hard right Republican organizations. She subscribed him to what she was reading, independent, more progressive media emails, like Alternate, Reader Supported News, Truth Out, that kind of thing. And when he got back from the hospital, I don't think he noticed. They were just political emails, and he was reading them.
Right.
You know, he had a little bit of both, whatever.
Right.
And then one day, it was after lunch, I think, if it had been watching Obama on the news, he said to my mom, I like that guy. You know, he's pretty good. And lo and behold, he ended up voting for him. But, okay, so the point isn't that his politics became aligned with ours. The point was that my dad was, like, free and happy and singing and not angry and not hateful. And it was the last few years of his life, and we became really close, where it had really kind of damaged us and damaged relationships before. This media is so potent as it's meant to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, longtime FAIR analyst Steve Rendell, who along with FAIR founder Jeff Cohen, appears in this work. Steve is an expert in talk radio, and he would often describe its power as having to do with the way it was consumed, which I think your experience just underscores. You know, in the case of your father, he started listening on a long solo commute to work. For other folks, it's going out to the barn with their brother. But, you know, it has to do with the way certain kinds of media, not just the way they talk to you, but the way they talk to you in a sort of isolated format. And yeah, right. This is where I think the book helps people see that this isn't accidental, that the messages that were coming through, it wasn't just your father. There was a game plan. It wasn't an unintended effect. The effect that it had on your father, making him angry, making him hateful, and making him particularly hateful towards particular groups, all of that was intentional.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Fan or not, Hillary Clinton, she was spot on in 1998 when she said there was a vast right-wing conspiracy. But the conspiracy wasn't just against her husband. Basically, far-right libertarian Republicans, you know, starting back in the 50s, actually, after Brown versus Board of Education, figured out that in order to affect the change they wanted, which was basically one-party rule by billionaire white men, they would have to create distrust in mainstream media. And one major way to do that was they had to label it as liberal. And that changed a lot of things right there. It was a very successful campaign. Mainstream or corporate media fell right into the trap. They folded, they leaned right, you know, they bent over backwards to not be labeled liberal media. And it's stuck today. And it's like they were like abused spouses, like, I'm sorry, what did we do wrong? But they didn't know that or understand that there was this plan. So control over the media was an easy-peasy way to get ordinary citizens into voting against their own interests and in line with billionaires. But eventually, of course, it metastasized to what it is today, like a weed that took over the whole garden.
Mm-hmm.
But the plan, if you want me to go into some detail and mention some of the points.
Pick some highlights. You know, the book does go through a number of landmarks in the creation of this right-wing media machine. We're talking about history here and not, you know, guesses about things. These are things that are documented. But there are a few things that stand out as, you know, important in moving us toward the situation we have now.
Right. So in 1969, after Goldwater lost to Johnson, Reed Irvine started AIM Accuracy in Media, supposed media watchdog group. It was really more of a media attack dog group. They still exist today. But they were the ones that first took on this goal to discredit the media as liberal. And interestingly enough, that same year, Roger Ailes, the creator of Fox, he was working with Nixon to improve his television image. And anyway, the following year, he submitted a memo to the White House, which had a scheme to create a new show that would put the GOP in a good light. Later on, then, that came in handy when Rupert Murdoch hired him to create Fox. But then the next year was Lewis Powell memo. This was monumental. And it was secret at first until a journalist discovered it, but nobody paid attention to it because it was just, it was like Goebbels said about the big lie, like you can't believe that people would actually do this. But it basically outlined steps to take for the vast right-wing conspiracy. It was designed as a anti-New Deal blueprint to undo, like, the New Deal and squelch all the social changes that were going on at the time. You know, they were going to influence college campuses, the pulpits, the media, corporate influence over scientists, and to create and fund think tanks, basically to push the free market philosophy. And then there was, in the 80s, the creation of the CNT, which was Christian-based, and thus the marriage with evangelicals happened. So the group got bigger. Then Reagan made Rupert Murdoch a citizen. Then he killed the Fairness Doctrine. And then the next year after the Fairness Doctrine was killed, we had Rush Limbaugh go national. And he reigned for decades, poisoning the minds of, I think his following was like 20 million people, not to speak of they got him in the military, so poisoning their minds too. But then the final big blow came with Clinton and Gingrich and their Telecommunications Reform Act of 1996, which opened up media ownership and cross-ownership, so all the big media companies got even bigger and squeezed out any, like, independent ownership. And then after that, just 8 months later, Fox News was hatched. That's it in a nutshell. Yeah. I do go into a lot more detail in the book. Well,
the book covers a lot of this history, and I just want to underscore the book and the film are not negative. They're colorful and engaging, and they're forward-looking, you know, which I think is maybe the most important thing. And so maybe to bring us up, you know, to now, I know a lot of listeners will be listening and thinking, oh, you know, Fox fired Tucker Carlson. And so, you know, maybe that means things are going in a good direction. But you and I know that whatever Carlson was fired for, it wasn't for years of sowing hatred against black and brown people, against it wasn't years of punching down, because that has been his stock in trade for years. So you also, and not alone, suggest that what we are learning around Fox's admissions, which are still coming out around the lawsuit, around Dominion and the voting machines, that that ought to remind us that Fox is not caring about its own viewers in the same way that it didn't care about your dad, and that it doesn't care about lots of other folks, you know. And I just want to say, a lot of folks are going to take that and say, well, I've done what I can do about Fox because I don't watch it. And
hell,
that's
no.
really all I can do. So what more can people do besides being angry, besides being sad and bewildered by all of the things that this book and this movie talk about? What are some things that you think people could do?
Well, first is to be aware of Rupert Murdoch, because before Tucker Carlson, there was Glenn Beck, then there was Bill O'Reilly, and then there was Roger Ailes. Okay, so he's just going to hire somebody else that's going to push forward his libertarian, let's turn people into Republicans so we can get tax cuts and deregulation for billionaires. So, Rupert Murdoch. So mention him as often as you can. Let people be aware. So as far as Fox is concerned, I mean, there's so much right-wing media. Fox is the tip of the iceberg, but it's still a tip. It's almost like if we can cut off its head, the head of the monster, that would be good. But one thing that we must do, we all must do, we must work to get Fox off of military bases. I mean, come on. They say they want to get de-radicalized the military? They can't be serious unless they get Fox off of the military. Every day they're radicalizing our men and women. I mean, January 6th, that had a large percentage of those that were arrested January 6th were military or ex-military. And one other thing about Fox, do you know that you pay about $2 a month in your cable fee for Fox, whether you watch it or not?
Yeah.
So
that bundling packaging where you're paying for stuff that you don't even watch, and that includes subsidizing Fox.
Yeah, and that's how they make their money, not so much ads. But you can petition your cable company to not pay Fox's cable fee. And right now they're negotiating with cable companies for a higher fee, probably in order to compensate for the $787 million suit by Dominion they have to pay for, which, by the way, they can deduct part of that from their taxes as a cost of doing business. But anyway, Media Matters has an easy nofoxfee.com web page. You can just click on one of their buttons, like if you have Spectrum or whatever you have. You can just click on a button and then send them a message, or they have the phone number there. You can call them. That should be easy enough to do. It would take about 5 minutes, and it'll make you feel really good if you do that. And then support local journalism and independent media like FAIR.
So there are resources also in the book for actions that folks can take, because it's not a dispiriting book. It's about things that we can do to resist what we acknowledge is a corrosive influence on our conversation and on, as the story tells, on our families and our relationships.
I've done 3 documentaries, and I've watched hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of documentaries. And I was always pissed off when they would present all this negative stuff and then just leave you with that. Like, don't do that. Tell me what I can do, or tell me what other people are doing at least, so we don't feel hopeless. You know, that doesn't motivate people.
We've been speaking with filmmaker, activist, and author Jen Senko. You can learn more about the film and the book, out now from Source Books, at thebrainwashingofmydad.com. There's lots of resources there in terms of taking this conversation forward. Thank you so much, Jen Senko, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me on, Janine. This was great.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show, you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our site, FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Again, listeners, we have we've got John Grant from the burbs of Philadelphia. You were saying The weather was like, what's the weather like out there?
Well, it's a bit chilly today. My tomato plants that I put out are struggling. I put them out and it was like 80 degrees a week ago, and then It went down to 50. It's still in the 50s and wet, and they're just barely hanging on.
My wife
should be warming up.
Yeah, I can't get her to let me haul all the houseplants out. She's just adamant.
Yeah.
A week ago it did freeze. It did actually freeze.
Right.
We had freeze a week ago. But let's get it over with. Let's get them out. Let's get these damn things.
We got all our plants out. And I figured, these little plants, tomatoes, are having a tough childhood, but that means they'll be tough adults, too.
Yeah. You're probably right about that, actually. They'll do fine.
They're hanging in there. They're not dead yet.
The locals out here that drag a piece of clear plastic over them at night. It looks like it's going to.
Sure.
That's what the locals are doing out here. I don't know.
Well, in South Florida, where I live, the tomatoes, they always complain about like three freezes a year. And they'd cover them. They'd have helicopters on top twirling the air. And they'd have huge burning piles of rubber tires with this horrible black smoke in the field. In fact, I used to help a couple times the squash farmer I knew, the redneck squash farmer, to burn tires.
What the hell? What a burn tires? Okay, I don't understand that.
Well, it warms the air around, and then they, if you're lucky enough to have the money to get a helicopter, you have the it swirls the warm air around. It's expensive, I guess, but at least your tomato crop survives,
Never heard of that. I did not know that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's Florida.
Well, the tomato farmers around where they were always complaining. It was too cold. It was too wet. It wasn't wet enough, agriculture is a tough business.
Burning. They don't do that out here, thank God. They do burn the pastures. And I burn mine. But that's a wildfire. It's nothing. Grass fire.
Right.
It's not serious,
just,
you don't use tires.
I don't think they do that anymore. It'd be illegal. I mean, the god-awful black smoke that come out of that is disgusting. Yeah.
That's pretty strange stuff there. I've never heard of that.
Burning tars? Oh, yeah. That was an institution down there. Burning tars.
Now they're trying to turn we're going backwards. You might get back that far again. I mean, historically.
Are going backwards. We were going to talk about the Comstock Act you had mentioned.
Yeah.
And very interesting. I looked it up on Wikipedia and all that. It's really crazy,
you're fresh. What did you discover with the
1873, under the administration of Ulysses S. Grant, which was a time of course Reconstruction, which ultimately failed thanks to the Ku Klux Klan and things like that. but 1873, and it was Mr. Comstock who worked for the U.S. Postal Service. And he somehow finagled this rule, this act on some level, that would make it illegal to use the U.S. Postal Service to send obscene material or information about abortions or abortion chemicals and whatnot, things like that, that it was illegal to use the U.S. Postal Service. Well, apparently this district judge in Texas cited that ancient law. It's like, you know, sort of like the Posse Comitatus Act, which they cite every now and then, these right-wingers. And that, you know, he used that, and if, you know, a certain interpretation of the law, I suppose, right. You know, people are saying this could ban abortions, you know, the pill being sent around by mail. But, you know, 1873,
well,
there was,
yeah.
1873, there was a U.S. Postal Service, okay? Well, if it says in the law that you can't use the U.S. Postal Service, well, hey, this is 2023. A lot of things have changed and evolved. Can't we use FedEx instead of the U.S. Postal Service, you know? And if you want to be, you know, use sophistry to twist these laws around like a bozo, which they do, the right wing does, well, why can't the opposition, you know, do the same thing, selective enforcement and all that kind of stuff, and say, look, okay, it says you can't use the Postal Service, so don't send the pills around, but you send them by FedEx, you know? It's like,
well, that
the legal system in this country has become so baroque and corrupt that it's just mind-boggling, frankly.
Well, I'll give you a quick comeback on that.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I'm not an expert on this, but
no, not
I know more about the Comstock. I know about how the Comstock law, was used here in this county in Northeast Kansas, and as well as a lot of other places,
mm-hmm.
the Postal Service to censor papers.
Sure,
and that's what they did. And this,
right.
But I'll tell you right now, why not FedEx or UPS? Well, all of these corporations are forced, they have to, if they want to do business across state lines, to sign on to the Interstate Commerce Act. So that,
okay.
I mean, that right there qualifies them as the equivalent of a postal service because they have to cross state
right.
lines.
Well,
so, I mean,
I guess my grasp of the law is not that good.
Well, it's not really. It's an act.
Right.
The newer act, this Interstate Commerce Act, is newer than the Comstock Act. The Comstock Act is absolutely. I did not realize it came about as early as 1873. I know its effect was felt here in Jefferson County, Kansas, with the newspaper. As a newspaper, this guy was a shit stir. I mean, he's a lot like you and I, John. His name is Moses Harmon. His name is Moses Harmon, H-A-R-M-O-N.
And oh, he has a much better name than we have.
Yeah,
Moses
Harmon. Yeah, I know. We're mundane compared to that.
That's
like mythic and
legend, you know.
Yeah, he came over from Missouri in the I think he was a unionist in Missouri, which was not popular. He was pro during the Civil War. And
yeah,
lost,
kind of a border state, Missouri, right? Yeah.
He lost his wife and his firstborn child. She died in birth, giving birth, and the child died also. So he was very sensitive when he married his second wife and successfully had a daughter. He was sensitive to women, you know, women. So when so when he started this new newspaper, when he moved to Valley Falls, Kansas, in the early 80s, these newspapers are kept and they're preserved, and I've read a great deal of them, and he was publishing letters from women all over the country who were talking about things like, why do I have to lose all the property? all my property for wanting a divorce. Why am I being raped by my husband and my I can't stop him from raping me? Why don't I have the vote? Why can't I even vote in this country? Why am I treated like a chattel slave? I mean, this is what women
Indeed.
Were writing. They were writing this. Mm-hmm. This is after the Civil War. Writing this in his paper, and he was printing it on the front page. These letters mm-hmm. to the editor, and it was mm-hmm. great. And a lot of people, and a lot of the I would call the more puritanical, theocratic
mm-hmm.
people in the county were pissed off about it. Never mind the other newspapers
right.
in the county; they all were pissed off because he was selling papers all over the country. People buy them all by the truckloads, you know.
Right, but a lot of people didn't like the message he was dishing out. Yeah,
and he did weird things. He did do things to stir up shit. He named the newspaper Lucifer the White Bear. I mean, right there, that'll get the Christians pissed.
Lucifer the White Bear?
The light bearer. He bears the lantern.
Oh, the light bearer. I thought that was Lucifer. Versus the, you know, a...
No, but that's what it was.
Never mind. Nightmare. In my mind is
shattered.
No,
don't worry Lucifer the Light Bearer. And he changed and he changed the calendar where it was like year 43. I'm not sure why he did that. I had figured that out.
Right.
But he would print on his papers the year of something, like 43 or something. And he believed everything dealt with. It was a very libertarian or anarchist type paper, except he disavowed violence. He did not think violence was a way to do anything. But
he had a torch for women's freedom and liberty.
Well, he let women write these letters. He let the women write under assumed names also.
Mm-hmm.
But so that got him in trouble a little bit with the post office. Locally,
right.
Okay, but they really weren't
right.
that yet. I mean, they weren't. What really got him in trouble? A court. Now, I pushed the local people around here, the newspaper
mm-hmm.
people, about this stuff, and they said it wasn't. They didn't deny that happened because it did happen. That's what it was. The Comstock
mm-hmm.
law, the postal, and the local postal clerk
right.
that drove the nail in his coffin, so to say. He ended up doing over as much as 10 years in three different prisons.
No,
10 years in three different prisons. And
now, hold up. Let me back up a little bit. Where in Kansas is this?
It's in right 8 miles from me, Valley Falls, Kansas. Where
Jefferson
started.
County. And what year would this have been? Era?
It was it would be 1879 through 1880, I would say 86
right, okay.
at the most.
All right,
okay.
thanks. Yeah, I just... want to catch up
with but what really now this is what bothered me the most. I started researching and reading his papers. They're still preserved in a national archive, and I thought wait a minute, nobody out here talks about this. So I
right.
emailed the editors of the paper, who are my friends, and they're still friends, but I said, why isn't there a memorial for Moses Harmon, you know, a brass
right,
plaque or
exactly.
something that this paper was printed in this town. The paper became world famous. It really did all over the world.
Well, Mike, you got your work cut out for you here. So write a story something. It's great stuff.
Yeah, I will.
Wow.
I will. I've already published a pamphlet, but I'm going to do more. But here's the thing.
Okay.
Here's the
okay.
kind of resistance you get. The local publishers of the local newspapers, okay, who are innocent descendants from the papers that censored, that encouraged the censoring. I mean, these are, years and years later, but they're the same copyright. They said, well, no, it wasn't that. It was that he let his 16-year-old daughter move in with his business partner, shacked up without getting a marriage license.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, his business partner, he was divorced, legally divorced, and he was 36 and she was 16, and wanted to move in with him, and Moses,
right.
he said, he wasn't bashful. He prayed. He says, they have my blessings, and they don't need to go to church, and they don't even need a marriage license in the state. They can move
right
in together.
Well, so, this guy's really an anarchist libertarian. You go going right to the source, baby. Wow. Well, you know, there was a recent citation in the news about a, where was this, in some one of these red state situations, where a guy was, some official in county government or something, was defending the idea of marrying 12-year-olds, girls, 12-year-old girls.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says, you know, he was some kind of fundamentalist. He says, well, he's certainly known a marriage that, you know, was she was 12 when she was married or something like that. And he said, it's going on. It's a fine marriage now, you know. And
well, I don't know. I don't know.
So,
so
a lot of fundamentalists defend that sort of idea.
Hypocrites. There were 16. Huh? There were 12-year-olds.
Well, obviously,
12-year-olds.
Yeah.
12-year-old girls, as soon as they ministrate, they were allowed to shack up with the men they chose, the parents chose, you know.
Well, I guess sort of the Mormon rule or something like that.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's just, you know, but anyhow, when Moses went public, because everybody was talking about the fact that Lucille was her name, Lucy was moved in with his business partner. Everybody was talking about it. Anyhow, so he went public. Says, yeah, they, you know, he approves of it. And he very carefully wrote out, she knows what she's doing. It's not going to be, you know, this is. Well, they arrested them all. They arrested Moses. They arrested his business partner. They arrested his daughter. They arrested his brother, Moses' brother, and put them all in the Jefferson County Jail, which at that time was really just sort of a concrete blockhouse. You know, it was really nothing.
Right.
And held them and let the men, the males, stay in it, and they took her and put her in the upstairs attic, basically, of the sheriff house, and they kept her separated. But the point was, with this thing went on for as near as I could tell, and I might be a little off on that, went on for at least I want to say 19 months, okay, and over a year these people were held in jail. Now there were other supporters who moved it, women who wrote these letters, moved into Valley Falls and kept the printing presses going and kept the paper coming out in order to keep the postal, second-class postal permit. And Tears came and kept the paper going while they were in jail. Moses got bailed out. He went to Topeka, went to trial. He got out again, and he took over the paper. But that's when the postal – that's when the Comstock Law came into effect. That's when – it was already in effect, but that's when these local – hayseed Puritans came up with the brilliant idea of having the Postal Service censoring. And they couldn't get it shut down immediately. I mean, they have to file for a permit violation, claim it's obscene material. And it has some sex. Well, here's where the sex came in. A woman named Markham, and I think I think Philadelphia. I think from the East Coast out there, Pennsylvania.
Ah, a Philadelphia thing. Okay.
I think. Her name is. Her last name is Markham. Mrs. Markham. M A R K H A M. She wrote wrote a letter to the editor about. It was famously called the Horse Penis Affair. The Horse Penis Affair.
Wow, that's a catchy title.
Yeah, and she was complaining about having to take a man's horse penis in her body involuntarily. She did not like it. She says, why do we have to do that in America today, you know? That's the camel that broke the straw. That's the straw.
I guess so, yeah.
Back.
I mean, yeah. They're talking about horse dicks, man. Yeah.
Horse dicks, yeah. And everybody went nuts out here. And it became national news. The horse dick affair became the national news.
Oh, you got it right about this. This is like a movie, a comedy. I can see it now.
comedy and drama. Because here's what happened. Yeah, right. They got poor old Moses. Now, Moses is already like 66. He was 66 when this whole shit fire he started got to going pretty hot and heavy. He did not get out. he became a national cause célèbre when there were photographs taken of him breaking rocks in a rock pile at Joliet Federal Prison in Joliet, Illinois.
Okay,
and he's an old man. He's breaking these rocks.
Uh-huh.
This is like 8 years later. It took him 2 years after that to get out, and he got out.
And he was probably in pretty goddamn good shape when he got out of jail, too.
He would think that, but I don't. Well, here's what happened in the reality. He got out, went to Los Angeles. Now, Lucille, the controversial daughter, had already dropped his business partner, remarried,
uh-huh.
and moved to Los Angeles and had a kid,
uh-huh.
and a baby.
Okay.
There's a very famous photograph of Moses, in Los Angeles, less than a year
uh-huh.
out of the federal prison system after he served
mm-hmm.
10 years. He gets out, he goes to Los Angeles to move in with his daughter and the new grandkid. A picture's taken
mm-hmm.
of him holding the grandkid. It's a very famous photograph, and he
mm-hmm.
dies. He dies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he didn't. Breaking rocks didn't help him, John. I hate to tell you that. So,
no, I guess that was a bad idea. Yeah, it was.
But it was sort of a tragedy in a way that
right.
that Valley, it started here in Valley Falls, Kansas, and persecuted him, and it was really one of the many, but this is one of the most famous cases of newspaper censorship using the Comstock Law. So,
my God, it's got all kinds of things in it as a story, as a narrative.
Yeah.
You know,
and those are the highlights.
Right. Well, it's actually relevant given that this federal judge, this half-assed federal judge, I don't know what to call him, but he was an anti-abortion activist. That was his job. That was his role. It was his being, his heart and soul,
right.
everything. And somehow, under Donald Trump, he ends up as a federal district judge in Texas. I don't know, even if he's a lawyer. You certainly don't have to be a lawyer to be a judge in those cases. And he's a guy who has cited this case, and, you know, it's stopped everything with this pill. And, again, if I'm correct, he's using the Comstock Act to, you know, to would-be, you know, make illegal these pills all across the nation, you know, being sent through the mails.
Yeah.
Or some facsimile of the mails, which I guess they legally attach onto. so, you know, that story is, you know, resurrected is really relevant here. I mean, it shows the what a zoo and a carnival the criminal justice system is. You know that this some act like this can be used. I mean, to me, it's a really entertaining story that's relevant.
It is.
Yeah.
It's a real throwback. To me, I was shocked when I heard this from the current newspaper people in this county
uh-huh.
because they
yeah.
made the bigger deal about the daughter moving in with the business partner.
Right.
They never even brought up the Comstock. I knew it. They knew it. They're in the newspaper business. They use the United States Postal Service to send their subscriptions all over the country, and they didn't even bring it up. And matter of fact, I pested them so much that one of them, a then editor, published a short piece about it. We're talking two paragraphs. I got a couple. And he never brings that up. He just brings up that it was a romantic, an illicit romance that got Moses
mm-hmm.
Harmon, got old man Moses in trouble. And I'm offended by that because that, to me, demonstrates it is true. From Valley Falls to Oskaloosa across the county, it's
mm-hmm.
about a 20-mile trip, and it is true. That there were buggies and buggies and buggies, horse and buggies, that would convene
mm-hmm.
at the Oskaloosa courthouse to watch this trial, to watch the trials.
Oh.
there was this sort of voyeuristic Puritan, you know,
equivalent of a media event in 1879. I love it.
Yeah. And they traveled 20 miles by horse and buggy. Crowds of these.
God, it's got everything in it. It's got censorship of newspapers. It's got raw sex. It's a natural for HBO. I can see it as a six-part series, you know.
But what, help solve this, here's the mystery for me. What is it so parallel to, and the Scopes monkey trial, all these, what is it with the Puritans, where they are so voyeuristic? Is it voyeurism? I don't know, John, but they're attracted to these, like, mobs, to anything that is, they perceive as perverse or something. I don't know what it is.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What smacks of me is that in incidents like this, those Puritans, as you call them, or busybodies, or whatever you want to call them, Puritan busybodies, that somehow there's something warped and twisted in their mind, and they project it on you. And so I'll never forget when I photographed at Widener University, I photographed these people, a guy that was doing graduate work, and I remember as I'm looking through the lens at this guy, I'm photographing one person after another, and this guy came up, and it was like, I'm looking through the lens, and this guy is a madman. I'm going like, it just struck me immediately like that. And this guy's whole thesis was on, around child molestation and children, and going like, God, this man is out the window, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, like, is there something in his makeup that he's, in other words, tamping down and forcing to control in his own being? In other words, he's super disciplining himself, possibly, you know, for, you know, sexual attraction to children or something. I don't know. But, you know, the idea that someone is so wrapped up in fighting some impulse in his or her being that the self-discipline becomes such a regime that it becomes projected out for the benefit of everybody else, although it may have absolutely nothing to do with anybody else. This 16-year-old girl may be very mature, and this may be a good, you know, a good relationship. You know, 16 is not, you know, is not.
Yeah.
A child anymore,
right.
if you're of a mature mind, and you know you're, so, you know, it's just that, you know, it shows that there are many people that can't keep themselves out of your life. They want to control your life. You know, they're barely controlling their own, and you know, I want to control yours too. You know,
well, these same Puritans, John, out here.
Right.
Would marry off their 12-year-old daughter to an older man if the older man had 100 another 100 acres of land. I mean, that's a fact.
Well, there you go. There you go. You talk about hypocrisy, but, of course, in the corrupt and crazy world we live in these days, hypocrisy stories don't amount to much anymore. We say hypocrisy, so what? You know, I mean, yeah, right. We're all hypocrites. You know, we're all...
Well, maybe that's a little glib. Everybody, let me try this one out on you and the audience. We're talking sort of local hypocrisy, puritanical government, theocratic government. Of course, this is Christians. There's not a Muslim among them.
Well, of course they're Christians.
Well, not even Jews. They're not even Jews. I mean, there's nothing there. It's just all white Anglo-Saxon Protestants and quite a few Catholics mixed in. So, I mean, it's
sure.
So when I moved out here in 1999 in the year 2000, Y2K time, I came out here. Besides Y2K, I would go up to get coffee at the what that was called. It was a coffee bar. Is what it was. It was called the hole on the hill, and I would drive four and a half miles up there, and that's my way of getting to know the community. And right. this is how predominant this male, this toxic masculinity is. I don't know how to explain it. The reactionary tide that started with Moses Harman in the 1880s and throwing him in federal prison, killing the old man practically.
Yeah.
I said, oh, you live in the Tucking house. That's the name of the family, the real name. And I said, huh? Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, that's the Tucking. He was cursed. I go, and I'd already heard some of the local teenagers say that our house is haunted, okay? And the house down the road is haunted, too. But these are teenagers, you know. But these are old men. These are 60, 70-year-old men drinking coffee with me. And they say that house is cursed. And I said, why is it? The Tuckings were cursed. Old man Tucking was cursed. Old man Tucking.
Wow.
Old man Tucking had been dead at least 50 years before these guys.
Well, you know, being cursed and being haunted are different ideas.
Well, I know.
Like,
you know,
as haunted.
I'm
cursed means there's bad karma around here, you know.
But do you know what the old man Tucking's curse was?
Mm-hmm. Well,
do you know what caused the curse for old man Tucking to be cursed? He only had daughters. He never had a son.
Oh.
And that meant this is the legend of the Tucking legend. He had 1,000 square acres all around that big house you live in, Mike. And he said he had to give it all away to get boys to marry his girls. He had to give it away because the girls had to have a dowry. And he said he lost all that land, Mike, because he was cursed with only having daughters.
Now that sounds like a very plutocratic sense of mind. It's like toxic masculinity and plutocracy all linked together there. In other words, you have daughters, you got to give all your land away. Whereas if you have males, you just accumulate more and more. You know?
And who cares if they got horse dicks? I mean, you know.
Yeah, horse dicks. We don't care. Yeah.
But I mean, here it was. What would that be? That would be approximately 120 years later. I move into this county, and I hear nobody knows. I could count on my two hands how many know about Moses Harman.
I'm into his story, man. I think this is a natural. As I say, I envision a six-part HBO series on Moses Harman.
We should pitch it. You should pitch it for me. I'll write the pamphlet. You pitch it, and you get it.
Maybe we can put our minds together and come up with something. Yeah.
Because I'm telling you, this is a great, crazy story.
Well, you know, the Hollywood writer's strike, maybe we could be scabs.
Yeah.
We could just go to Los Angeles. Fuck it. You know, we're not in the union. Hey, we got a great story for you here.
We'll write it, and we'll say, no, you can't use it unless you stop the strike.
Right.
That's what I bribe him. I said, no, it's such a great story, you know, you can't use
it.
It is. It's a strike. But around 120 years later, I still hear this crap. And it's still, and that's now 20 years later, most of these old men are dead that told me about the curse of the house I live in. But I mean, I'm just sort of like, I've lived and learned, I've dealt with the newspaper editors about the use of the Comstock law. And the next thing I want to do is, are they going to, and my post, you know, I mail my little booklets out to people all over the country through the post office.
Right.
Her name is Ruth.
Right.
She's a nice woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ask her, are you going to censor, you know, the...
Well, you never know. You might have
some
dirty little nugget hidden away in your newsletter there. You know, you never know.
Right.
Some little bit of obscenity that you're sending out in the U.S. Postal Service. You know,
yeah, well, they used to.
Better keep an eye on you, Mike Goodell, I'm telling you.
Well, they should always keep an eye on me, always. But I'll tell you something. I don't know. This is a gray area for me on the Comstock.
Uh-huh.
Is that why Playboy for a while or other magazines like that had to be mailed in a brown paper envelope for a while? I can't remember. Do you?
I don't know. Well, it's someone who wrote two short stories in Penthouse magazine, I'm an expert, of course. I don't know. I guess maybe that was just decorum or something. I don't know. Look at how ridiculous it is nowadays. Look at the Supreme Court and obscenity. Sending through the mail, wherever the hell you get it, it doesn't matter. I mean, you think of it, in 1873 when the Comstock Act and what the idea of obscenity was. It was a pretty amazing thing, you know. And, of course, I used to know a historian who loved to go to original sources. And like, back in the colonial days, one of the main crimes was men having sex with their animals and things like that, you know. I mean, there was all kinds of things going on. I mean, I'm not kidding, you know. So the idea of obscenity changes, evolves over time. Well, now the Supreme Court over the, decades and decades and decades since 1873, anything goes now. I mean, copulating with animals, you could do anything and send it in the mails, And so it's amazing that in this corrupt world we live in, where there is so much absolute corruption about everything, that it's so libertarian, the state of mind we live in, kind of, that somehow the legal system can accept the view from 1873 is somehow having any kind of bearing on today. But yet they do it. This guy comes out of nowhere. He's an abortion activist. He becomes a federal judge. He makes this law. He passes this ruling for some reason. And everybody, stop the presses. Why can't we just say, oh, shut up. That's ridiculous, I don't know.
Well,
it just shows you the political and judicial system of America is really, really, on the edge and corrupt. It's like look at the the Senate is about to now hold hearings on the lack of ethics in the Supreme Court of the United States of America, with Clarence Thomas being the poster boy for unethical, corrupt, behavior as the top judge of America, and you go like, wow. I mean, think of how the whole history, Clarence Thomas. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible.
Don't we pay him enough? I mean, one of the first FBI agents I met, I asked him. Goddamn. I mean, we get paid a lot of money, Mike. We're not like city cops. And I said, why? And he said, because that keeps us. I said, what do you mean? He said, we make, we start out about $96,000 a year, $60,000 just to entry level, $96,000, you retire easily with usually more. And I said, wow, that's good money, man. And he goes, well, that keeps us from fucking taking bribes, Mike.
Yeah, well, that was probably in the 80s and 90s or something.
It was right 2000. But here's the thing. Don't we pay these goddamn Supreme Court judges enough money that they don't have to go out and, this is what pisses me off about
obviously,
people.
Mike, quote, they don't have to go out and, take a half a million dollar yacht excursion through Indonesia with some fucking billionaire's yacht and not report it. They do not have to do that. They want to do that, and they are able to do that, and they don't give a rat's ass whether you like it or not. And then he's going to vote on, what you can do and what you can't do. The fat slob. Don't get me going
Well, the FDA, I'm trying to. The FDA approved 20 million doses of this pill. It's safe. It's not dangerous.
I know. It's safer than Tylenol. You know, it's like
that's right. And these people out here, it's definitely safer than having a baby. I mean, pregnancy is a dangerous thing for a woman, and a lot of people do not want to admit that. They think it's natural. Well, it is, but it has a high. There's a high.
Well,
you know,
a lot of natural things cause the death of the body.
Right.
You know,
right.
We're living and dying at every moment since the doctor smacks you on the ass. You know,
So the
myriad little cells in your body are all struggling from the moment you start to the moment you end. You know.
So this other one, not just Thomas. There's this other guy, Gorlitch. I can't pronounce his name. He's a Supreme Court justice.
Oh, Gorlitch. Gorlitch or something like that.
And Alito are taking.
Neil Gore,
These are quiet little corruptions too. These are ones that. Now that they're digging into the press, the Fourth Estate is digging, and they're finding out all these silent real estate deals being done that enriches these judges, man. So Clarence Thomas is sort of like he just falls to the walls, private jet fly free, and, you know. But these other guys
balls
are doing
to the wall
it.
Corruption. All right.
and these other guys are doing it on the sly, you know. And I'm like going, I haven't heard shit about Sotomayor and the Kagan, who I don't like her, but I mean the women on there, you don't hear one news story about their corruption.
Well, there was a Time story a couple days ago about this particular George Mason University, something like that, and they have this right-wing college that's ascendant now, and they've got Thomas on there, you know, they give him money and they lavish him with this, and all these guys, conservative guys, they lavish with this, you know, they just had some junket they all went on, or a number of them went on, and, you know, the Kagan and the other liberal woman went on the trip, and they were, you know, chumming it around, you know, and it's just so unsavory. The more you read about the Supreme Court, it's just, and then you got Israel, of course, our little micro United States in Israel, you know. I mean, they're going through their own version of manifest destiny with the Palestinians and all that, and you know, now all of a sudden, you know, Netanyahu's got the Supreme Court there, you know, by the balls. It's kind of the opposite of the United States. The Supreme Court over there is more moderate. It moderates the government, whereas the government is going racist right wing like you wouldn't believe it. And, of course, you know, we're pals with Israel. You know, they can't do any wrong. And, you know, and speaking of Israel, McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, has just virtually invited, he was in Israel, invited Netanyahu to once again speak before the House of Representatives. Remember when they dissed Obama when Netanyahu spoke to the House of Representatives? They're thinking of doing that again. And
I would not even attend that. As protest, I would not attend it. If they forced me at a gunpoint to attend it, I would turn my back on them. I would stand up.
Well, the Democrats, a lot of them boycotted the one, you know, where he dissed Obama. But it's really, really, really sad to watch, frankly. But
it is. I have to bring it up because it's in all the headlines now. What are you thinking about this debt ceiling vote coming up? We're only 30 days or less, 28 days and counting now to the deadline, according to the Federal
Reserve. I know. And you got McCarthy. McCarthy, you know, is like a, you know, he's got all his Matt Gaetz and Margaret Taylor Greene and all those people chewing at his ankles all the time, and he's totally scared to death of them. And so these guys, you know, this idea that the right wing of America, the armed AR-15 right wing of America, chaos, hey, fucking hey, bring it on. Let's bring on chaos, you know, and chaos will only accrue to benefit us on the far, far right, you know, with all the weapons and the guns. Okay, you know, there's nothing better to solve the chaotic problem than to have a lot of guns, you know. It just makes it all better. And so what are they going to do? I mean, the House of Representatives, dominated by these right-wing lunatics, are they going to really, okay, if we, you know, shock doctrine and all that, if you know, that's what we need to get power in America, this is the perfect opportunity for them to experiment with that and take it to the wall. And, of course, Yellen, the treasurer, the finance person, you know, and a lot of people say that this could be catastrophic. I've heard that word used a number of times. In other words, they don't know. In other words, will it be like, you remember when 1999 to 2000, the computers were all going to go awry and with the date thing and all that. Remember the Y2K crisis, which never materialized, right? So it's all, we're getting almost a panic like the Y2K. What are we going to do? What, it could be catastrophic. Well, it may not end up like Y2K with nothing, you know. It may be catastrophic. It could be, you know.
Well,
in other words, the world could be waiting for a massive depression to happen to resort the world. And all it takes is something to trigger it off. And this could be it. The U.S. refuses to pay its debt, you know. And what do? They repossess your car when that happens, you know. Well, you know, the crisis and the catastrophe could be, you know, basically the world deciding to, you know, collect on their car and things like that. I'm a little worried, frankly. You know,
well,
not that I have anything to do with it, but, you know. It's
Well, the immediate obstacle is, one, the bare majority the House of Representatives has of these crazy people, and it's going to take I'm not sure about this. It takes 60 senators in the Senate to pass the to get to it. Now, that means at least 10 Republicans are going to cross over and commit political suicide.
Well, I don't know whether the vote, you know, has to have a joint vote between the House and the Senate. You know, they both had to vote, and then they have a reconciliation, and they figure it out, or they don't, you know, and it doesn't get passed, and it never gets to the president's desk. So I don't know if they need a filibuster number.
I heard that this morning on
could be
BBC, BBC and NPR both. How are they going to get? How is Biden going to get to 60? And that's going to be a big.
Well, you know, we didn't have this polarized lunatic situation we have now with and the money being, you know, with the rich being so goddamn rich and whatnot, that sanity. Yet we probably, you know, do need to cut back on expenses. Like how many trillion dollars are we in debt in this country, and China owns a lot of it and all that stuff. We probably should back off that stuff, but you can't do that unless you really effectively redistribute wealth in America. And you grow up a little bit and you say, okay, you know, we have to change our ways. We have to think about climate change. We have to think about these reasonable things that we all can live together in the future and that's coming and all this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, we could probably spend less, but we maybe have care for each other more, as ridiculous as that sounds, and, you know, actually have a real, quote, society, you know. But, you know, that's like naive pie in the sky. You know, you can't talk like that. And, you know, it's, you know. silly.
Maybe
it is.
So we're
at each other's throats, and we'll, you know, it's a tough time, you know, really, really.
Yeah, I'm sort of stuck on that that thinking of it. It's sort of like, do we have to go through individual crisis before we can find solidarity with our neighbors and see other people in crisis?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we have to go through this real human tragedy and experience and survive, and realize that the only way we can survive is like some sort of union activity, you know, some sort of solidarity.
Well, yeah, it's cooperation and competition. And, you know, America is so worships competition because it's a capitalist society to the max that, you know, cooperation is only something, as you say, as you just suggested, is an act of desperation when nothing else works, you know. As I always joke about, about how you should proceed in a difficult life, when all else fails, lower your standards, you know. So that kind of thing applies, you know, when all else fails in a competitive climate, well, I guess we better cooperate. But, yeah, the place is like a cinder at that point, you know, and it's like, I don't know, maybe that doesn't make sense, but, you know.
Well, I got a question. Last week, I asked, I know you have some pretty esoteric films you watch. Did you get a chance to see the cheapo series Don't Pick Up the Phone?
Oh, no, I put a note last week I didn't do. Don't pick up the
phone.
Where is this again? Tell me again.
Netflix.
I'll look it up.
Netflix.
Okay. Well, I got
now,
one
reason,
for you then.
Well, wait a minute. The reason I bring this up again, because it's related to what we're talking about. I mean, Don't Pick Up the Phone on Netflix. It's a limited series.
Good.
And it is, can you imagine this? 200 young, you were talking about young women.
Right.
Working in McDonald's and Taco Bell and all these, being convinced over the telephone. Now, they're not convinced, but the managers, the store managers on 200 of these across the country over 10 years, 200 phone calls are made by a guy impersonating a police officer, a detective at that, convincing the managers of these different fast food joints to have these young women, I guess there's a couple of boys too, young women strip search. The manager strip searches the girls.
And does
cavity searches. And no one figures it out. It took a while. It took over 10 years to figure out who was doing this and how it was done. And I mean,
this is like the story Gay Talese wrote a book about a guy. He did this for like 20 years, and he had a motel. He bought this motel, and he had the attic above all the rooms, and he put little holes in it. He could watch. He did this for like 20 years or something.
But this is even worse, because is a hole in the ceiling. This is a hole in the ceiling. This guy is convincing over the even women.
Well, they're sexually abusing people is what they're doing. Right.
They're sexually abuse people. This is like what was that? The Malcolm test, or where they went back in the 50s, where they would
the Milgram experiment. Milgram experiment, right? Yeah.
It's where they turn up the electric juice on people actors.
It's okay. Guys screaming in the other. Oh, it's okay. It's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. And they didn't know that the guys were actors. Well, I mean, this is only real. I mean, this is real crap. I mean,
this is real humanity. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, these are innocent.
I got a movie for you.
Okay,
I got a movie
go ahead.
For you. On Netflix, I think. Anyway, a Netflix. It's called I Care a Lot. It's called I Care a Lot, and it's got wonderful acting, and it's about this centers around this woman. She's a real cold-blooded bitch, let me tell you, but she's very good at it, and she sort of works at an old folks' home, right? And she's figured out the ins and the outs of finding people who don't have a lot of relatives around, but they have resources, and they may be getting old and sorting out, you know, losing capacities in this. And she figures out how to become their legal guardian. So she has this wall of people that are she's the legal guardian for, and it's kind of an essay on a really horrific possibility for a very real unfortunate future, you know, how to manage people in the future, and also a noir. There's a little bit of a noir in there with a sort of a gangster, but it's also a comedy, and it's very dark. And but it's I've seen it twice. I loved it. Care a lot. Yeah,
a lot.
I care a lot. Yeah, and it has. Yeah, Rosamund Pike is the actress. She's very good. And anyway,
yeah, I haven't seen that.
So I'll check out.
Yet.
Don't pick up the phone. I will.
Phone.
Check
it's
it
real
out.
Simple. It is. It's a lowbrow true crime. I mean, it's not.
Lowbrow true crime.
I mean, it's sort of like. But what it exposes is this atomization of people in this country and the ability for somebody that sounds like an authority for us to carry out. It's really sort of a peep show into the American mentality of the similar thing that the Nazis did in Germany. I mean, they could.
Well, you know,
it's
related to this. I care a lot. The themes aren't that far off. You know, these two movies. Yeah. Series and a movie.
So,
we are
taught to obey authority from the cradle to the, you know,
no
and
question.
Like that.
No question.
And
no
even
question.
even when it's against your own interests, I mean, it's
right.
really a strange, and I think it's a sad commentary, but truthful commentary on the way the mentality of many Americans today. And I think that's one of the reasons, well, probably to economic catastrophe.
I think you're right.
Beginning June 1st, because I think it's just like people don't have any sense of solidarity until.
Yeah, I think we could have a really rough summer. It could be very, very bizarre, certainly as we go into new election. And God, I mean, I think especially next year is going to be like a real roller coaster. Craziness, you know, like the whole Trump thing, every week it was like, oh, my God. And it was like next week, oh, my God, no, oh, my God, next week. You know, every week was like something more bizarre was happening than happened the week before. It's like buckle up. I think we're ready for the roller coaster here.
I think there's a whole
new school of these movies, and the other one was The Triangle of Sadness that I saw, which is like, I mean, it's even hard to describe what it is. It's like a ship of fools, basically, of 2023 characters, and it goes awry. It has Woody Harrelson in it.
I like Woody.
Who plays an absolutely irresponsible drunken captain of the ship.
Triangle. What's the name of it?
The Triangle of Sadness. So I mean, like all three of these shows are on the new theme about what the fuck are we doing in this world and. Where are we going? And oh my God, we better buckle up. You know?
John Grant.
All right, Mike. Take care, my man.
All right, brother.